All right, it's the truth about markets in London, 104.4, and the Tories are in number 10 Downing Street. Stacey Herbert.
They are, as is apparently the Lib Dems.
Right, right. Tell the people.
I was just reading today, actually, that Vince Cable,
my man Vince Cable.
He was trying hard to get the Lib Dems to do a deal with the Labour Party.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't want to do a deal with the Tories.
Mm.
But they're in power. But I also want to note that this week another all-time new record high for gold in pounds sterling.
Euros and dollars
as well, yes.
Everything across the board. Record new high for gold.
In fact, the biggest jump was in the gold price in Swiss francs.
Yeah, Swiss franc is looking bad. You know, I say that it's not even doing well against the dollar. And because of Swiss franc, interestingly enough, Switzerland is having its own massive problem, just like the Eurozone and just like other countries around the world, including the U.S. But yeah, Swiss franc was down.
Well, you have to wonder because everybody's, you know, the big problem in the world right now is just so many debts out there. They were merely transferred from the banks to the governments.
Yeah.
But, and the countries having the worst problems are those that had the most bank debts, private debts, you know, bank-written debt to the GDP. Mm. And one of the highest in the world was Switzerland. It was just around the same amount that the UK had, less than what Ireland and Iceland had.
Right.
But, you know, not too far off.
Yeah, well, you know, the debt problem is tantamount to the problem, the overriding macro problem, which is deflation. Now, on this show, you know, we've been talking about deflation for a couple of years, and paradoxically, it is driving the price of gold higher. So it's not inflation that's driving the price of gold higher, it's deflation. Ultimately, they're tied at the hip at something called loss of purchasing power. So as the debt implosions are cratering these various economies, people's purchasing power is being decimated through various means, and the net result is that gold is going higher. Now, this may result in true currency crisis, and then you could say, yes, it's hyperinflation. But the jump from deflation to hyperinflation would jump right over inflation.
Well, but also, I mean, this is a unique period of deflation that's happening during a time where there is just global debt-based currencies in use.
That's exactly correct. Now, in the blogosphere, you got Mike Shedlock, who really, I must say, as of 2 years ago, I really started to pay closer attention to his deflation outlook, and he turned us on to Steve Keen, who's been a guest on several of our shows. He's a guest on our show again this week on The Ed Show, which will be up on YouTube probably tomorrow. What?
By the time you're listening to this show right here on Resonance 104.4 FM, it'll be up on our site, maxkaiser.com.
Check out our
interview with Steve Keen, who just won the Revere Award for the Paul Revere Award. I think it's for Paul Revere. The British are coming.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Well, especially with the Tories in party, you're going to have a lot of that going on. A lot of kinky stuff with those Tories.
Yeah, but so go on. Steve Keen.
Yeah, Steve Keen, yeah. He's a deflationist, really. Came to us via Mike Shedlock, who is a big... Now, at the time, you know, Mike Shedlock was at odds with the guru du jour of the day, which was Peter Schiff, who's an arch-inflationist, as are other high-level, high-profile bloggers. Trying to think who else is in the inflationist camp. Certainly, Eric Jansen over there at iTulip is still Mr. Inflation, inflationist camp. And I think you also have... anyway, the thing was, he was in the minority. But I think, you know, you can safely say that, A, he and Steve Keen were absolutely right. their call on government bonds in the bond market was absolutely right. Even recently, some bozo at PIMCO said that government bonds had peaked and that they would only go down from here. This was only a statement made 2 or 3 weeks ago. Meanwhile, yesterday, bond prices hit another higher highs. So, this deflation is the driving macro force. And I'm curious to see, remember in 2008, Peter Schiff had a really challenging year. His accounts were down something on average 50-60%. Then he bounded back in 2009. 2010 so far, it's been a bit of a coin flip. But with the dollar rallying as it is now, I think the inflationists and the Schiff people are going to have another very challenging year this year. He was a guest on our show a couple weeks ago. A lot of fun.
And,
yeah.
Well, anyway, so Mitch Shedlock, of course, he's self-taught. He's just, reads financial information and economic information.
His background, I think, is in computer programming.
And he makes his own decisions and judgments and calls.
So is Steve Keen.
Steve Keen is a doctor.
He's an engineering.
He's an economist. Yep.
He's not really an economist so much. He hates economists. Neoclassical, neoliberal economist. He says they should all be thrown in the volcano in Iceland, as I paraphrase, of course.
Yeah, so he focuses on modeling and, in particular, financial instability and Minsky's, building on Minsky's works.
Yes, I saw something interesting. The Minsky moment was really that day in August 2007 when BNP said they weren't going to value some of these derivatives at 100 cents on the dollar anymore. That was the beginning of this momentous global credit crisis, which had a reprieve last year as all of that money printed up, really debt, more debt, by the central banks made the bank stocks go higher, which had a wealth effect, increased purchasing out down there at the mall by those who have money invested in these things. But now it's all unwound again and we're heading to lower lows.
Well, actually, John Authors from the Financial Times wrote a fantastic book where he talks about the market. And we've talked about this before, but it's just out now. The book is out now. And he's talking about the synchronized global bubbles and the synchronized, therefore, collapse.
Right.
But he mentions the collapse of those two hedge funds operated by Bear Stearns in 2007. So a year before they themselves collapsed, but just their hedge funds collapsed. And it was actually provoked not by regulatory requirements or anything, but by the banks themselves who owned the debts, were on the other side of the trade with Bear Stearns.
Yeah.
And Bear Stearns was looking just for, continuation to roll over their debt to continue to fund these things, their CDOs, their collateralized debt obligations, which were packages of subprime mortgages. And until this moment in June 2007... they had never, ever been traded on the open market.
Right.
None of these CDOs. They were just traded between banks.
Mm-hmm.
So these banks wanted to collect. They forced Bear Stearns to basically try to sell these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it had never been tried before. And then it was tried in June 2007.
Oh, they need to be tried, all right. They need to be tried by a jury of their peers, strung up by their ankles and flogged.
So they were brought onto the open market.
Yes.
And the at 100 cents on the dollar.
No.
And they plummeted. They were,
yes.
I don't know what the exact number was, but it was like
bad.
Bad.
Yeah. Hey, it was about that same time that you had the scandal with Revco.
That's correct. The I think it was Revco. Like 5 or 6 weeks later.
That's right. Revco blew up. And I think Jim Rogers actually had a lot of money with Revco. And, I forgot to ask him about that. He was on our show this week, which will be aired next week on RT. Jim Rogers.
He got his money back. What happened with the Revco thing is that it was supposed to just be a depository account. So they were supposed to they weren't supposed to commingle their accounts, right? It was cash deposit with Revco. That's not supposed to be used by their own company. It's supposed to be held in account for Jim Rogers and the other people who had stuff held in account there. Revco, they were derivatives traders.
Market makers.
So they weren't supposed to use his money unless he asked them to use his money on his behalf. Anyway, so...
Well, yeah, brokerage firms always use your money unless you specify when you open your account that this is a to be held in the customer name and not in the brokerage name, in the house name, in the...
Yeah, so that's when it collapsed. I remember Jim Rogers saying that they weren't supposed to use his money. And so when the assets of the company were seized and it collapsed to nothing, I don't know how he got it back.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I said we should have. I wish I had asked him about how that all resolved itself. Oh, speaking of Jim Rogers, you know, he said something very interesting on the show, which I'd like to talk about a little bit here.
Well, yeah, which part?
Well, we were talking about naked short selling. And the fact that the investigation into the bankers in Iceland by the authorities, who are now prosecuting corrupt Icelandic bankers, name in the list of charges counterfeiting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't gone into the, what do they call it there? What are you going to give
someone? The entire arrest warrant.
The warrant, the arrest warrant. I haven't gone into it to see how they... come up with counterfeiting the verbiage they use, but I would imagine my little senses tell me that they are referring to naked short selling, which, as anyone
the people out there probably have no idea what you're talking about because you failed to mention the fact that
every time I start to make a long sentence, you pretend like you're snoring.
I only did it once.
Oh, okay, sorry.
What?
I don't mean I'm this is the talk fair.
This is the former chairman and CEO of Kaupthing Bank, who is now living in Chelsea, West London. Chelsea, London.
Yeah.
And he is there's an arrest warrant and an international arrest warrant out for him on Interpol.
Yep.
And they're looking for information on his whereabouts. But anyway, so go ahead. He's being charged. They're looking for him on counts of fraud, deception, and counterfeiting.
Yeah, that's right. So I think counterfeiting has got to apply to naked short selling because what is naked short selling? It is not like a short sale where you're borrowing some stock and then selling it, what you borrowed, and then hope the price goes down. You buy it back at a lower price and return it. You make the difference as a profit. The risk is that the thing goes up in price, then you got to buy it back at a higher price and you lose money. No, naked short selling is you're actually selling something that doesn't exist. So if there's, let's say, for IBM, let's say that there's a 500 million shares outstanding and somebody comes along and they sell into the marketplace 20 or 30 million shares that don't exist. They're not part of any of the 500 million shares that are officially part of the market capitalization of that company. So that's the same as counterfeiting. So when I brought this up to Jim Rogers, he said, well, in defense of naked short selling, he said, well, China just allows for naked short selling, which I read also in the Financial Times. They just said, yes, they want to encourage naked short selling, number one. Number two, he repeated some little Wall Street ditty about, well, you know, if you're going to commit a crime, the only thing you have to worry about is getting caught.
Yeah, he was saying it's not a crime unless you get caught.
Yeah.
If you naked short sell and you win, you don't have to deliver.
That's right.
But if you're on the losing side of the trade with this naked short sell, then you have to deliver. And if you can't deliver, then you go to jail.
Something, yeah, more or less along those lines. So the standard for the law. Is the standard for the law the letter of the law or whether you get caught?
Yeah, but the other interesting thing, I think, is like he wasn't at all fazed by you bringing up naked short selling and didn't even deny that it exists. But there is this weird cabal of weird group of people. I'm sorry, I spit on your face.
No, that's all right. I'm used to it, honey. That's one of the reasons I like you.
No, but there is a weird group of people in the world for some reason are... have this cult of there is no naked short selling.
Right, there is that weird cult, especially over there at Wikipedia, where they refuse to post any entries that refer to naked short selling. The guy over there at Overstock.com, he had trouble getting his stuff on Wikipedia.
Patrick Byrne, and then it all comes down to this guy, Gary Weiss, who is, I guess he's a business journalist, a finance journalist for Business Week or something like that.
Right, now I had an entry on Wikipedia for a couple of years because... Max Kaiser, the ratings riser, of course, would have an entry on Wikipedia. And then we made that film for Al Jazeera, which mentions naked short selling.
Yeah.
And suddenly my entry disappeared for about 9 months. And then we started doing the BBC show. So they're like, well, we can't ignore the ratings riser anymore. We have to put him back on Wikipedia.
But actually, it's quite interesting. So anybody out there, you know, you can go to Wikipedia and check out naked short selling. And look at the history. You can see the whole discussion there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of things like in 2008, I think it was Hank Paulson or, you know, when the whole market was crashing.
Oh, do
there
I?
There were quite a few.
That.
They came out themselves and said, you know, we're banning naked short selling.
Right. That's right. That's
And the fact that it was said by the Treasury Secretary to the press and to the media that was then posted on, attempted to be posted on the naked short selling thing, which is locked down. You're not allowed to make any changes to it.
Right.
But they were trying to post this information. And the Gary Weiss people were like, this doesn't prove it exists. And now, you know, we were talking to this big hedge fund manager and famous investor, and he's like, yeah, it exists. And China's now allowing it officially.
And he gets into all cute about it. Like, well, it's naked short selling. You must do that. But if you get caught, you go to some crazy little ditty. I could start doing a dance, a jig or something.
But then there's this group that will, no matter how many major market participants say it's happening, they just refuse to believe it.
But, right, because they don't like the idea that there's a group of people in the financial community who are counterfeiting stocks, bonds, options, and currencies.
Well, but also their opinion is that if that exists, then penny stock scamsters can't exist. That somehow they're mutually exclusive. They can't exist. Only one of them can exist at a time. They believe that all naked short selling is actually penny stock scamsters.
Right. They refuse to accept it happening at the sovereign level.
Yes. Or in the, you know, S&P 500 level.
Right. Now, when I was on Al Jazeera a couple of years ago, during the 2008 meltdown, I made a reference to the counterfeiting that was going on with U.S. government treasury bonds, that they were selling naked bonds that didn't exist. And, you know, they were thinking that this was not based on facts. And now we know that it is based on facts. Now,
yeah, the Treasury itself has reported that there's been failure to deliver on treasury bonds, which should tell you, I mean, that's counterfeiting is major crime. You're printing actual money, the U.S. Treasury bonds. Somebody was basically, they weren't even having to go through the whole process of actually printing them.
That's right.
It's all digital.
Okay,
they just
now,
have to say they own this and they don't.
Let me throw a number at you. 9-10. Ring any bells?
9-10. Was that right before 9/11?
That's right. Do you know big news story on 9-10?
Donald Rumsfeld saying that the Pentagon was missing $2 trillion.
That's right.
Yeah. Were they naked short sellers?
That's right. That's right. That's correct. And, of course, you know, connect the dots. But let's move on. So, in other words, what about last Thursday's 1,000-point drop? Let's touch on that one because there's now more information coming out. This is the May 6th 1,000-point drop. I see you bowing your head. Are you sleeping?
No, I was
trying to touch your chest with your chin? What's going on? You're praying?
I'm praying, yes.
You're praying? You're praying that I get hit by a bus?
In our apartment up on the 7th floor?
So this 1,000-point drop. And my phone go ding-dong. What the heck?
It's probably your phone company. They sent, you know.
Oh, it's my psycho landlord.
Oh, God.
I'm going to text back. Go blow it out your
canoe. Max.
What? There's a jerk off. Anyway, so where was I? Oh, yeah, the 1,000-point drop. So a lot of talk about this one.
Tell us. Speak on it.
Well, it's, of course, you know, it was a lot of vagueness for a few days. People were unsure where it came from, what it was about. I had my thoughts on it, which were published, duly published in various blogs and on MarketWatch.com. And the basic premise of my assertion was that this was an attack, basically. It was an attack on the market. Now, you had at the same time circulating the fat finger theory that somebody made a mistake. So, you had another theory that somebody made a typo. They meant to type...
That was the fat finger theory, that they pressed B for billion instead of a million.
Okay. Then you had basically just computers gone wild, I guess, is
a
one
computer
theory.
Glitch. It was a computer glitch, like somebody unplugged the machine accidentally or something like that.
Right, the flash crash. Then you had the theory that the computers basically just shut down for some reason that caused wild problems. Now, according to last 24 hours, we've got the CFTC.
Gary Gensler.
Gary Gensler, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, isolating the whole problem down to one trader, Waddell.
Waddell, yes. E-mini contracts?
That's right, the S&P mini futures contracts.
And it's emerged, he refused to name who the person was or the company was. And it was in testimony in Congress where he said they had isolated it to this pretty large trade, which ended up being 9% of the market in S&P futures that morning.
Yeah.
And it was about $2.4 billion worth of shorts, basically shorting the S&P futures.
That's right.
And it's now emerged that it was just one company, Waddell.
Right. Now, the 75,000 contracts were tossed into the market at one time.
Yes.
And it caused a 1,000-point drop in 15 minutes.
That's correct. Prior to that as well, the markets were already dropping. And in particular, the yen-dollar trade was starting to really unwind fast, about an hour before this. So it was already, the momentum was already down.
Right. Now, so if a single trader is throwing a 75,000 contract order into the market and crashing it by 1,000 points, does that constitute an attack? Or is it a hedge?
Well, they're saying it's a hedge. It was a legitimate hedge.
Right. And, the explanation given was that they manage a lot of money in the stock market, and this was meant to hedge. But they also acknowledged two things. Number one, they lost money with the trade. And number two, if you are trying to hedge a portfolio of stocks, the purpose would not be to cause the market to crash. That doesn't make it, doesn't add up.
Uh-huh.
That's not the way you would hedge. You would not hedge a portfolio by throwing 75,000 contracts into the market, sell contracts. That's not a hedge. So you have two choices. Either it's a trade or it's a hedge. Now, the word hedge is used gratuitously and used incorrectly most of the time, as is the phrase market maker. And to me, it does, the hedge argument doesn't make any sense because, first of all, the amount of money under management by this group is not commensurate with this contract in this period of time, in this frame, this time scale, or anything that you would normally associate with a well put together hedge.
Yeah, no, because I forget the size of it, but it's like a $10 billion fund. It's not that huge where they're placing a hedge of $2.5 billion.
That knocked $1 trillion in market value off.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In other words, if you were not even PIMCO that manages $200 billion, okay, this hedge would even be bigger for them. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't make any sense on the hedging side. So that means that it is, therefore, by process of elimination, a trade, a directional trade, as you would be either a buyer or a seller, thinking prices would either go up or down. So therefore, it is a trade. So you have one person making a trade, which is enormous, 75,000 contracts, that attack the market. Now, so my basic premise of an attack by a single person using financial weapons holds up under this scenario, number one. Number two, the CFTC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, is also part of the whole regulatory framework that is come under scrutiny by lawmakers who understand now that the regulators and the rating agencies have been co-opted and conflicted by the same group of funds and managers that have essentially hijacked the system for their own private gain. So, and therefore, that's kind of my point I want to make here, is that my thought that this was an attack meant to create destruction still holds up now, a week and a half later. There's nothing I've heard to dissuade me from this basic position. The evidence that we've come out so far from the CFTC now confirms some of the elements of my position. What's missing would be the connection between this group that made the attack and the political operatives who benefited, those people in Washington who had a bill being passed to break up too big to fail banks. Okay, that link has yet to be made, but based on what we've been told so far, that link can still be made. There's still room to make that link because it's an ongoing investigation. They're still saying it's an open mystery, and they're still working on it. I believe.
Yeah, but also, you know whose name was also involved early on was who's the black swan guy? Talib, Nassim Talib. And there is this notion where everybody, you know, this herd mentality, and people come up with these all sorts of weird ideas, and then they all start doing it and thus create it. And so, you know, maybe he was trying to create a black swan event. You know,
but a black swan event and an attack are two different things, because a black swan event is unpredictable. And the whole point of Nassim Taleb's fund is to have a perpetual straddle on the market. You're both long and short, and you're going to pay for that straddle during the course of a year, and it may cost you 10% or 15% of your funds to maintain that straddle. But you hope that during the course of the year, there will be an outlying event like we saw last week that will more than pay for the 15% cost of the straddle. And in fact, you're going to make a lot more than 15%. So it's a basic strategy that's been around since listed options were created in the 1970s. And as I asked Janet Tabakoli this question, I said, to me, it seems like Nassim Taleb is overrated, because all he's saying is the black swan is it's just a strategy based on maintaining perpetual straddles. And they've been around since the 1970s. And if there's a genius somewhere in the mix, it would be the guys who figured out the options volatility formula, which are Black-Scholes options volatility formula. It's nothing to do with Nassim Taleb. He came up with the black swan title for a book. That's very clever. But underneath it is absolutely nothing new. And not only that, but reportedly he lost money on this event. Now, getting back to our Jim Rogers interview, I asked Jim Rogers about Nassim Taleb. I asked him if he was overrated.
He didn't really want to answer that, but this bit doesn't make it to the screen just because.
That's too bad. Because let me fill in the blanks because it wasn't in the interview. Rogers says that Taleb is overrated. And which I think also Janet Tabakoli has also indicated to me that she feels that this guy is overrated. And because basically he's not presenting anything of originality other than a flashy title. So now getting back to the 1,000-point drop in the market, I maintain that the only thing missing now is the connection between the trader that the CFTC has isolated and the folks in Washington. And we know there's a pipeline of information between Washington and Wall Street. We know that going back on this show, we reported 2 years ago that the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, had opened up a pipeline between Washington and Wall Street to give them first dibs on information relating to drugs that were going to be approved or not approved. They said it would be a way to help, quote, make markets and, quote, hedge, end quote. No, that's insider information. That's market manipulation. Also, just as a programming note, I did an interview yesterday with a futures trading magazine in the UK on box office futures contracts. I don't know when it's coming out. Look for it. But it should be very interesting.
You know, one of the problems, as you mentioned, this insider information of proceeding with financial reform, as they call it, but is that the politicians creating this legislation, of course, have refused to unexempt themselves from insider trading laws. So U.S. politicians have an exemption. They're allowed to trade on insider information.
Yeah.
And they don't want to get rid of this exemption.
No, why not? It's a kleptocracy.
Well, this seems that's amazing. It seems like we should have some more storming of parliaments around the world.
Well, it's happening on the periphery countries like Ireland and Greece. And it's working its way toward the center. Also, interesting note is the new Max Kaiser action figure will be soon available.
And you're not lying about that.
No, it's being put out by a company called thatsmyface.com. And there's a model with wearing a lapel button that says F the IMF for people down in Greece.
Speaking of the IMF.
See, I'm hoping a lot of people in Greece will wave the Max Kaiser action figure to the cameras while they're storming the parliament. This will be great to get good traffic to maxkaiser.com.
Speaking of the IMF, there's a coordinated attack on the U.S. this past week. It started with Mervyn King. Earlier this week, the Bank of England governor, Mervyn King, irked U.S. authorities by pointing out that even the world's economic superpower has a major fiscal problem. He said, quote, "Even the United States, the world's largest economy, has a very large fiscal deficit." These were his words. They were rather vague, but by happy coincidence, the International Monetary Fund has chosen to flesh out the issue today. Its cross-country fiscal monitor is not easy reading, and it is a very big 17-megabyte PDF. So I've collected a few of the points. The idea behind the document is to set out how much different countries around the world need to cut their deficits in the next few years. And the bottom line is it's going to be big and hard, i.e. 8.7% of GDP in deficit cuts around the world, which works out to, gulp, about $4 trillion.
Right. Of the $700 trillion in derivatives. So they're unwinding the derivatives, and you take $4 trillion out of actual wages for these austerity measures, and that means about $400 trillion probably in derivatives have to be unwound, which means that the bank stocks are technically worth zero. And we saw that on Friday. They were all down sharply. It looks like right now every major bank in the world is technically worth zero. So the question is, how are they going to keep these banks' stock afloat?
Well, listen, every bank stock, every country in the world is worth zero in our current monetary system, in our current pounds and dollars and euros. So we have to just start over. Just like walk away from that old system and start a new one.
Well, that's what a depression's all about. You know, that's what this depression will bring in, an opportunity to reset the clock. And I think America is no longer the country that's going to be setting the pace in terms of so-called democracy. We have to look to countries like Iceland that are progressively introducing new laws to favor free speech and freedom of the press. And this could be the basis for a new country that could lead the way around the world and could attract 300,000 or 400,000 immigrants to Iceland. And as I spoke with Jimmy Rogers about this, or was it Steve Keen? No, I mentioned this to Steve Keen. It'll be on the Edge program this weekend. Steve Keen, I asked him, I said, can't Iceland simply offer economic citizenship for people? Maybe for $20,000, they can own an Icelandic passport. If they sold 500,000 of these, they could quickly raise $10 billion. You know, he was like, yeah, it's a good idea. Shouldn't there be a competition? I mean, Greece, Iceland, Ireland, they should all offer economic passports to people in America and Britain and around the world who are being tyrannized by their own governments. We should be able to buy our way into other countries. I mean, why are we all being told that we have to stay on the plantation? I mean, I'm not in favor of slavery laws.
Well, Iceland can. I don't think Greece and Ireland can because of their
part
of the EU.
That's right. They've got a leg up on this race to attract the brightest hardest working people in the world can flock to Iceland. You can double or triple the population of the country in 6 months simply by offering economic citizenship, which is already offered in two major territories. Let's see, it's Nevis.
St. Kitts Nevis.
St. Kitts Nevis. It costs $200,000. Or Dominica. That costs $75,000. So why can't Iceland just offer for $20,000 economic citizenship, compete with those other territories, and immediately raise $10 to $15 billion for their economy?
So he talks about the really interesting stuff is in the detail. And what leaps out again and again is how much of a hill the U.S. has to climb. Exhibit A is the fact that under the Obama administration's current fiscal plans, the national debt in the U.S. on a gross basis will climb to above 100% of GDP by 2015, a far steeper increase than almost any other country. And then there's some charts to show just how sharp the rise is in the U.S., that it's taking on way more debt, way faster than any of these European countries or the UK.
Well, 2 years ago, that would have been really a critical point in terms of the competition that was being offered by the euro and the eurozone as an alternative world reserve currency. But now that the euro is crushed as an alternative world reserve currency, the US is still now the only currency left that it qualifies as a reserve currency. So they can run up debts in perpetuity. There's no checks. There's no checks and balances. If any country complains, they send in the military and they blow them to smithereens, to wit Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq. These are countries that decided to maybe trade oil and resources in some currency other than the dollar, and they were summarily executed or in the process of being executed. So that's the advantage of having the world's reserve currency and the world's biggest military that sucks up 50% of the global military budget for one country's protection of their really sick currency, the U.S. dollar.
But the level of debt isn't the only problem. Then there's the fact that the U.S. has a far shorter maturity of government debt than most any other country in the world, meaning that even if it were borrowing any extra cash, it would have to issue a large chunk of new stuff each year as things are. The killer table to show you that is this one, which shows a country's gross financing needs. In other words, how much debt it has to issue in the coming year just to keep itself functioning. And Britain has one of the biggest deficits in the world. However, because it also has the longest maturity of average debt in the world, it doesn't need to roll over so much debt each year. They're saying that basically, you know, with a large amount of financing need constantly on a day-in, day-out basis, essentially from the U.S., that they're subject to the so-called liquidity crises.
Right. Well, and that's a problem if there's inflation. That is to say, if interest rates move up from the current rate, which is effectively zero.
Yeah.
But as long as the U.S. can keep manufacturing deflationary events, like the attacks on May 6th, which was a manufactured deflationary attack, or the collapse of the eurozone, which is based on a lot of the fraudulent accounting that was brought to Greece vis-a-vis Wall Street.
I see, because there were several mentions of this, that there were quite a few failed auctions, U.S. Treasury auctions, and consequently, the day or two after the May 6th attack, as you call it, there were very successful. There was a flight to Treasuries.
That's right. There's the Treasury, the 10-year bond note, when it was at 4%, you had guys at PIMCO saying, that's it, we're never going to see anything under 4% again in our lifetimes. And it promptly traded down to 3.65% because of this very fact that you're not going to have inflation, therefore higher rates, therefore difficulty in rolling over Treasury bills and commercial paper in the U.S. as long as the U.S. has the ability to manufacture deflationary events in various countries around the world, as they're doing right now, and also in their own country. For example, the problem in the Gulf Coast. Now, that is causing deflation in a huge swathe of the American economy because it's stopping the fishing industry and tourist industry in that area. And there's not going to be any quick response to rebuild that anytime soon. It'll just be left to rot. That's deflationary, which keeps interest rates at a very artificially low pace. And Fed Chairman Bernanke, in his next testimony, will say, in light of the Gulf Coast disaster, we've decided to keep interest rates where they are.
Yeah, the other question I have about BP is they seem to be some sort of a hitman for the U.S. You know, they operate on behalf of the U.S., but are able to claim sovereignty elsewhere. So why is it always that the BP is the one that their plants explode, their facilities sink?
It's a special relationship.
Yeah, because none of the U.S. companies have any of these problems, not since Exxon Valdez. So what is it? Why do they keep on? Like, almost every year something happens from BP in the U.S.
Well, you know, that's why they felt compelled to be the oil major of the world, to spend the most of their income on greenwashing. Remember the famous Beyond Petroleum campaign, to give the impression that they weren't, in fact, eco-terrorists for real. But in fact, they're just basically the front man on the war against the environment, BP. Thank you very much. Now, the CEO said that the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, down there in the southern United States, he said that, well, to tell you the truth, it's a huge ocean, and the relative size of the spill is tiny.
Yeah, and the hundreds of thousands of tons of just loads of retardant, all these chemicals are just blasting into the water without any, nobody's allowed to have any oversight of how much, what is in this chemical, what are the chemicals they're dumping, and how much, and is it safe?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I noted on our site, maxkaiser.com, that this argument was kind of the same argument that financial engineers use. That the way we're, you know, with all these derivatives and all this special system with these sophisticated investors that we have, is that, you know, the global economy is so big that if there's a spill in one of these sections of the derivatives of fear, like, say, in subprime, it'll be contained because the whole financial system and the size of our derivatives of fear is so giant that it won't pollute the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, as John Authors points out in his new book, all the trading going on around the world now is completely correlated, and there's no such thing as escaping one disaster in any other part of the market. They all blows up at the same time. But this guy, Tony, from the CEO of BP.
Tony Hayward.
Yeah, Tony Hayward. You know, he says that the spill in the Gulf is teeny compared to the size of the ocean. And it made me think of basically the brain of a mouse.
Brain of the mouse?
Yes,
how?
If you put a brain of a mouse alongside the brain of Tony Hayward, you'll find that the Tony Hayward's brain is teeny when you compare it to the size of the brain of a mouse.
Uh-huh. I think he kind of looks like Tony Blair.
Why is this man the CEO of anything beyond the local chapter of the, you know...
Because you have to be smart to become the head of the local chapter of the local council or something like that. To run an international company and support the financial oligarchy and terrorists, you need to be able to say that with a straight face.
Well, he's an eco-terrorist, okay? Let's say that. And, you know, people have accused me of being an eco-terrorist in the press, and wrongfully so. I mean, let's say that the rightful application of that phrase would be somebody who's done what they've done in the Gulf of, in the United States. You know, that's the country of my birth. That's, you know, somebody is from another country has come in. Now, what if Tony Hayward was Muslim? I mean, would have shot him by now.
That's a good point. It's like the very same, all the attention came off of the Gulf of Mexico and this oil spill as soon as this guy from Pakistani-born U.S. citizen who planted they're calling it a car bomb in Times Square, but it was just a bunch of fizzly stuff that didn't do anything. So... And it had no possibility of ever exploding because he used all the wrong ingredients. But, you know, all sorts of new laws are being brought in. They're going to be able to now suspend, you know, take away your passport and your citizenship rights and all sorts of crazy stuff happening in order to stop a possible person who's too stupid to even put together a car bomb. But mm-hmm. This guy, you know, this company causes tens of billions of dollars in damages. Not only the damage to the environment, but all these people who can't fish now, or the tourism, things like that. And 11 people died.
That's right. And they've capped their liability to $75 million.
Yeah, but the population, there's no change in laws. Nothing happens. People don't seem to be scared. They don't treat that as like a threat
Right.
More than they
I don't understand. The blood gushing out of the dead people that were attacked by Tony Hayward is the same color as the blood gushing out of the people who get attacked anywhere else. Why are we discriminating against the blood gushing out of this person or that victim? Because this guy's white. Tony Hayward's white, so therefore he's innocent? Come on, give me a break. Britain. It's British Petroleum. It's your country. It's your oil company. Your guy, because he's white, he's innocent? Oh, that's right. I forgot. Anyone who's not white is a criminal.
Yeah, but it's all across. It's obviously, you know, I don't know, many people around the world.
I just love these guys, at least, at the very least, they should force them to come onto a show like this and try to defend themselves so that the people can see them tripping over their own words and expose themselves as the cowards and utter terrorists that they are. But, of course, you never see that either because they'll be on a commercial on TV in 6 months saying, oh, we're BP, beyond petroleum, beyond accountability, beyond redemption. We're financial and eco-terrorists, and you die! Ha, 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 sucker! That should be their next ad. Rightfully so, because that's exactly what they've done. There's no attempt to curb their actions at all. That's not good. That's not right. Oh, well, good thing I don't live there. What else?
On the flip side of this argument about the U.S. debt, unlike Japan or Britain, the U.S. does not have a central bank with quite such a large stock of government debt. Both the Bank of England and Bank of Japan have done so much quantitative easing, buying bonds with printed money over the past few years, that they have the power to cause a fiscal shock if they decided they wanted to sell off their bonds at once.
Uh-huh.
So, apparently, the other countries are doing more. It's all just relative. Everybody's doing the same disastrous stuff. So what's the, everybody saying, well, what's the big deal?
So, what? Repeat that again? They're buying insulating material?
Well, no, they're saying that the IMF is saying that the U.S. has the worst budget deficit problem in the world.
Yeah.
And they have a 17 megabyte PDF file with all sorts of charts showing it.
Yeah.
And this is an article in the Telegraph I'm reading from where the guy is going over the main points. And the main points being that the U.S. is accelerating its debt faster than any other country in the world.
Yeah.
It's shorter term debt than any other country in the world.
Yeah.
On the flip side, they're saying, however, Japan and the UK are basically the only buyers of their own debt. So they're just it's called quantitative easing, but they're only buying their own debt. At least the US has other buyers of their debt.
Yeah, exactly. Like China buys the U.S. debt because we were talking about this the other day. They saw that in the late 90s what happened in Thailand when the IMF came in and imposed austerity measures. They had no way to bribe the IMF because just like the U.S. dollar reserve is the world's reserve currency for buying stuff like gold and oil, it's the only respected currency for bribes. You know, and the IMF takes more bribes than any organization in the world. And they only take dollars. So there they are in Thailand. They're imposing austerity measures. This is why the U.S. last week shipped 1 trillion fresh U.S. debt dollars to Europe, to give the bureaucrats something to bribe the IMF with. Otherwise, they would be left with nothing to bribe the IMF with, and the entire economy would collapse. And you see what happened over in China. China started to buy euros to defend the euro because that's their hugest export market, even bigger than the U.S. So what did they use to refill the coffers of the European Union was U.S. dollars that they need to sink back into that economy because that's the only currency the IMF takes under the table. So, again, it's great to have the world reserve currency. It's great when interest rates are near zero, and it's great whenever you need a deflationary event to drop a bomb somewhere or to cause a big oil spill, and you can create deflation on command. And that's the economy in the U.S. and the world. And they're going to take the ecology down to that no longer supports human life, and it's happening in real time. That's not a debatable point. And it gets into that whole area of climate change. And I had lunch with a guy yesterday who was trying to tell me that climate change, global warming was a hoax. And it's just absurd. You know, when you just put your face out into the open air and look out around you, it's obvious that you're sitting on a kindling box that's exploding and there's not any habitat left. Except for those who live in their underground bunkers that they've constructed with the billions that they stole from the ecology and the economy.
Well, and so in conclusion, he says, he's asking, is the U.S. another Greece? And it says, he says, of course it's not, because it's not part of a monetary union, and so it can devalue its currency. And we see this, obviously, our race to devalue your currencies, the competition to devalue the currency and beggar thy neighbor going on around the world. But so it, then his final statement is reassuring. So the upshot wouldn't be an IMF bailout of the U.S., but a collapse in the dollar and possible hyperinflation in the U.S., but it would be horrific all the same. America has time, but not forever. Oh, okay, that's okay. So you won't have to go to the IMF, but you might have a hyperinflationary collapse.
Right, well, okay. So gold is on you know, track to get over $5,000 an ounce. And people who started listening to this show when we started broadcasting, when gold was 200 pounds an ounce, it's now over, it's close to 900 pounds an ounce, going to 3,000 pounds an ounce. So, you know, just, we're sticking to our basic core program here, is to assume the worst and buy gold.
Well, it seems that all the countries are having a difficult time devaluing. Everybody seems to have the same solution. Well, it's just like a Ponzi scheme, isn't it? Because everybody gets into the housing market because prices keep rising and they think they'll always have somebody to sell to, and they don't save anymore because they figure, well, their house prices are constantly going up. So it's a great savings machine. But of course, as soon as everybody, all the baby boomers start to retire, they all try to sell their house at the same time. And the same thing is happening with the currencies is, you know, everybody thought, well, you know, we could always solve the problem when it happens. We just devalue our currency. But you have to devalue it against something. And now, after the, during the first Great Depression, it was everybody did it. Australia was the first to do it. They just devalued their currency against the gold because everybody was on a gold standard. So it was literally, you could just decree it. But now they're trying, they have to try to force the market to create the illusion they want to create.
Right. So they're inducing hedge funds to impact political policy, the quid pro quo being that the hedge funds get to keep all the profits and the politicians don't have to actually work, which is why, in my opinion, these hedge fund inducement is the most powerful weapon yet that the activists have yet to use.
Well, and, you know, but the thing is that these currencies can only devalue against each other. There's nothing inert out there that they can devalue against. It's just against each other. So if the dollar devalues, it's devaluing against the yen, the yuan, and the euro. And what do they do in response? They say, oh, gee, great, we're happy. No, not in a deflationary collapse. They say, how do we get our currency to devalue? Well, then they come out with, oh, Sarkozy said he's going to leave the euro. Shock, the euro collapses, you know, relative. And it drops by 2, 3, 4% in a week.
Well, that's right. What you're describing there is a deflationary debt collapse and currency crisis, which is happening in the UK and it's happening around the world. The only currency going up is the US dollar and to some degree the Japanese yen. And because it has this unique position of having the world's biggest military. That's pretty
the
much
US,
it.
Yeah. Not Japan.
That's right. Well, the Japan funds America's military. They're not pacifists. Just like if I hired a hitman to go kill somebody, that doesn't make me a pacifist. I'm still guilty of murder. Japan finances America's military machine. They're not pacifists at all. They're warmongering just as the U.S.
In fact,
is
in
doing.
A law of court, in a court of law, that would be more. They would be more guilty.
Right. So Japan is no freaking pacifist. And they've used all their life savings to finance America's war machine. And that's ultimately all the currencies are valued against America's war machine. So at the moment, and until that ends, then you're just going to have this continuation of the model. And hopefully gold will get to such a point. Of course, the biggest, the most ardent critics of gold are the people who have a vested interest in the military, like General Electric, which owns NBC, which owns CNBC, which is out there saying gold's in a bubble. Of course, because if gold were to actually break out to its military dictatorship-adjusted level, it would put the military dictatorship of America out of business, and that's not good for General Electric, although a little bit of a caveat there. I think GE may actually have sold NBC recently, But anyway, the basic, all the board members sit on each other's board, so you can't, it's just shuffling the pack, the terrorist pack. How's the terrorist pack doing, by the way? The pack of playing cards of financial terrorists.
Oh, yes. Well, we haven't really posted. Well, I did post it in the comment section a few weeks ago, but there is progress being made by Jay Eichinger.
Yeah.
That he's making a pack of playing cards, which are financial terrorist cards, and they'll be available very soon on maxkaiser.com. I believe there's already been a few orders placed just by linking to it in the comment section. So
yes, well, the Max Kaiser action figure, I'm doing a deal right now. It's going to be distributed exclusively through Infowars.com. We'll see whether they buy into that deal. And so we're going to, that'll be available hopefully in the next week or so. And also another, we're working on a radio deal for America. We'll give you more details of that as it's unfolding. But we're looking to do a deal now for syndicating radio in the United States of America, coast to coast, which it'll be another Truth About Markets-like show to add to our London and New Zealand as the Truth About Markets conquers the world and my plastic spawn, the Max Kaiser action figure, is an army of plastic truth seekers out there in the globe to basically populate the globe with the plastic zygotes of the truth, which will float in the cybersphere and blogosphere freely to instigate further advances in the global insurrection against the banking occupation.
Well, everybody should on the site should be able to make their own plastic doll.
Yeah, you can. You can, after we get this distribution agreement worked out, then we're going to open it up to anybody, any site in the world that wants to distribute the Max Kaiser action figure can do so, and they can keep the proceeds. None of the proceeds come back to us. I'm not taking a penny of any proceeds from the Max Kaiser action figure sales.
Well, they'll be around in several thousand years. Everything else will be gone.
That'll be the only thing left on planet Earth. I'm hoping that my plastic garbage is the predominant garbage. So it's like the pharaohs of ancient Egypt leaving back the pyramids. When they dig up civilization here in 100,000 years and they find the landmines, the landfills, I mean, full of all the plastic, and most of the plastic will be Max Kaiser action figures. I will be...
There will be landmines, too. They're still there in Laos, which is the most heavily landmined country in the world, thanks to America. Cluster bombs all over the place.
Landmines and landfills.
Landmines and landfills. That's it for this week's Truth About Markets.
All right, then, until you all say goodbye. What? Bye, y'all.